Welcome back to the show, everyone. Today, I am joined by Gary Lederman. So this episode is religion, death, drugs, and sexuality in the 21st century. And you can clearly see why I was excited to do this one with Gary. This is the second time that Gary's on the show. Gary is a professor of American religious history and cultures at Emory University. He teaches and writes about death and dying, religion and sexuality, and sacred drugs. He is the author of Don't Think About Death, a memoir on mortality. His other books include An Exploration of the Sacred in the New American Religious Landscape, Sacred Matters, Celebrity Worship, Sexual Ecstasies and the Living Dead, and Other Signs of Religious Life in the United States. He's written two books on the history of death in America, The Sacred Remains, American Attitudes Towards Death from 1799 to 1883, and Rest in Peace, A Cultural History of Death and the Funeral Home in 20th Century America. And whilst this may seem like a pretty morbid, pardon the pun, podcast to do, I think it's a really important one. I think we're very death phobic in the Western world, and it's something that we always kind of shy away from. And you have a look at some of the more Eastern cultures who are very accepting of death. They're also very accepting of some of the more, shall we say, normal parts of suffering that come about in life. And I think having a very good acceptance and awareness of our own mortality provides us with an invitation to live more directly in our lives. So it's really important, I think, to explore these concepts in life, because it's going to happen to all of us. You know, they say that death is the ultimate equalizer, and I think that's a very pertinent understanding of it. So without further ado, I give you Gary Lederman. Gary, welcome back, my friend.
I'm so happy to be back. It's nice to be a part of this conversation again.
Yeah, definitely. Well, like we said before the show, so much has changed, which is really a scary concept when you think about it. I mean, it's been a couple of years, but it's not like it's been 30 years. the technological innovation, a lot of these kind of socioeconomic forces outside of, world war potential, not that we want to go down that rabbit hole, hopefully, climate change, the big one that I'd love to start this conversation off was the rise of AI and ChatGPT. And I read that article that you sent me, and it was actually a really optimistic viewpoint. I really loved that, because a lot of people, especially in universities and colleges, are kind of scared of that. But you have a different perspective. What's your take on the rise of AI and ChatGPT and so forth?
I think it's unavoidable at this point, and if not already, a part of the academic world in ways, I think, that faculty and maybe administration have been slow to realize. Within the span of a year, yes. It's happened so fast, but it's here and here to stay. So I didn't want to, go in the crisis mode so much, think about all of the potential major implications. I mean, for me, I really wanted to refocus on the question of what is education, and what do we expect from people who go through. The primary school, high school, and college. I at least wanted to, through my own story, talk about ways in which, you might learn to live with AI and not lose what I find to be the deeper purposes of education that have to do with the life of the mind. More so than technical skills or thinking about careers.
I'd never drawn that distinction prior to reading your articles, specifically the article you sent me recently, because you do think about what a college and higher education and so forth is designed to do. And it is designed to get you to think and to question. And I wonder why that's why, if I just look back on on all of the podcasts I've done with lecturers and teachers and so forth, there is a left-leaning bias that I've noticed. And I kind of like that, because I probably have a bit of a left-leaning bias myself.
Yeah, I guess you can call it left. I don't know. It's a weird, it's a commitment to the value of knowledge and knowledge acquisition, which comes in all kinds of forms. So it's not just like this exclusive liberal arts thing. It's like, how do we integrate, along with computer science or economics, well, my job, you know, the study of religion. So
yes,
trying to maintain some kind of emphasis on some existential questions and sort of what I think are sort of deeper issues that also prepare you, you know, for the future, for adulthood, and for whatever is ahead as these students get out of college, in my case, since I teach at a university.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, that probably lends itself to another thing that's happening at the moment. I'm not sure what the data suggests, but I feel like there's so much questioning going on in this day and age, which is obviously a wonderful thing. But something that I've noticed in working with clients as a counselor is that people are really concerned about the changing value of things. And you know, one of the best things that the internet has done is that it's completely blown out the middleman with so many different things. You know, and information is probably that big thing there. Do you have I'd really love to hear your take on this, Gary. Do you what in terms of the value of a university or a college degree in this day and age, do you see that changing? Is it diminishing? Is it increasing? What's that been like for you as a lecturer and a professor?
Well, it's completely gone to hell.
Right.
Excuse me. That's a little over dramatic.
Yeah, sure.
I sound like the old guys, you know, when I was a young gun.
Yeah.
So maybe it's perennial or something with generations, but sure. There is a sense, again, that things have really changed dramatically. And just questions around what does a teacher do in the classroom with students isn't so simple anymore. All kinds of forces at work, and I don't want to kind of single out or blame anything in particular, but you know, certainly to single out a couple of things in particular.
Yeah, sure.
I think partly we have you know, a kind of administrative expansion. Mm. So that is middle management, you know, in a lot of ways, that only leads to additional kinds of paperwork, and you know, certainly assessment is a very key catchword in education, at least my experience today, that again may be helpful and good in some ways, but can get in the way in other ways of just, I don't know, being yourself, trying to get to know students, work with students, and not being so preoccupied, you know, with how is this going to play out in terms of numbers and quantification and things. Yeah. So I don't know, that may be something to think about, and certainly the financial disparities, but also I think a collapse for many colleges and universities is symptomatic of deeper kinds of attitudes where, mm-hmm. you know, education isn't a top priority. You know, it's actually pretty low in many states here. And that has all kinds of political implications for sure. But, you know, in any case, there's a lot going on in so many ways that kind of educational culture that I might, you know, that spanned my career is changing. Whether that's for good or bad, I guess, you know, we will see.
Yes.
I'm you know, I'm kind of pessimistic about education.
Yeah. In what way?
Based on what I was just saying, it's just not valued so much in many societies, and that the value may be, again, focused on different kinds of knowledge acquisition around the sciences, again, things that are important and, you know, critical for students. But hopefully there isn't a kind of equal value for, you know, I think for literature and history, and, you know, as I've said, religion, other kinds of humanistic leaning studies. And that's part of the decline, I guess, for me, that feels threatening or concerning, is the humanities decline in terms of numbers of students and majors, you know, university resources. I will say, you know, for sure that I am lucky being at Emory, where there is, you know, some efforts at keeping a balance on what it's like, you know, for a undergraduate to go through a curriculum, general education requirements, and acquire a degree. But I think it's few and far between. So those are a few things.
It's a funny one for me. I'll bring myself into this just for a bit of context as to why I reached out to you and why I really valued our conversation last time, and also why, you know, what you just said really kind of hits home for me, is because so I work as a counselor. I'm still studying, actually, and I'm going into honors into psychological science, and then, you know, perhaps down the clinical pathway after that. The real love that I have is around understanding belief systems and ideas, and, you know, and you can see how religious ideas and psychedelics and, you know, reality itself come under that picture, because to me they really represent religion, especially, as well. And we can talk about, you know, the fact that it's such a broad definition after this, that idea of belief systems really kind of acting as a first principles influence on how anyone sees the world, and that dramatic the dramatic implications that would have for a clinical industry, you know, a counseling into like how someone sees the world based upon how society that they're embedded in sees the world, you know. And it's I find myself in a funky place right now, because as the world, especially my industry, becomes trying to make psychology a harder science, you know, let's look at the data here, and moving away from the soft science aspect, which is where I really find my heart. I'm in this place where I could do these courses, you know, that are very holistic, and they're about spirituality, and they're about they bring in psychedelic assisted therapy ideas in there. And then I see, well, if I do this degree over here that I kind of find a little bit boring, well, that's where the job and the money is, you know. So I kind of see myself, do I do that and then just in my downtime study this and get people like yourself, who I really love, on the show? And, you know, do you know what I mean? It's that hits home for me too, what you said.
Well, and I mean, maybe that you're embodying something that is happening within psychology today. It's been a trend more recently around, well, I suppose, to put it in the terms you've been talking about, you know, how to incorporate spirituality into therapy, making people whole or feel better or, you know, do better. And I think, again, that struggle, at least is a struggle, I think, right? I mean, in some sense, there's a way in which you know, the sciences have so taken over so much of how we think about health.
Yeah, yeah.
But also mental. And that's because, you know, it's been very successful to have that sort of, perspective and worldview. But on the other hand, it's also left some things out, and we've seen where the gaps are. So the past, I think, few decades have seen this, I think, effort to slow down all the biological kind of more neuroscientific approaches to thinking about, mental health.
Sure.
For this conversation, and I don't know, what the answer is, because you do have to weigh all those considerations about, in terms of your sense of your professional life or vocation, what really feels like the right path. Again, for your patients, but not just for your patients, but
sure,
as well. I think it's too bad that the programs like the one that you're in and others, most others, really don't have that capacity to think about how to mix up the curriculum, think about ways of training that cut across this, religion and the sciences, to put it in those terms. Yes. Although certainly much more complicated than that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. You find it funny how, people say, can science and religion, ever get along, as though they're asking, can cats and dogs ever get along?
Well, yeah. that's right. That's one way to look at those dynamics, I suppose. And there's also ways in which they overlap in some interesting ways, where science can be considered religious, the study of religion can aspire to be scientific. So it's kind of interesting in ways that work against that strict dichotomy.
Yeah, definitely. It's a funny place we're in right now, because I feel that we've pushed so hard on the scientific front, which is I try to look back on history with a dose of optimism, and try to recognize the significance as to why things kind of morphed into the way they did. And we had such a subjective viewpoint, and then starting to take our own ego out of the picture, you see what happens with the scientific method, Francis Bacon and so forth, and you go, okay, well, what is actually going on outside of this? Can we just be an impartial observer here, and then we get to where we are right now. I wonder sometimes, I really love your perspective on this, whether you feel like we've almost thrown the baby out with the bathwater, and we need to find a balance between understanding the objective world, but also the significance of our own internal experience and how we find meaning in our lives.
Right. Again, a real longstanding struggle, I think.
Yes.
In the post-enlightenment world, that we are still somewhat working inside of. That's the challenge, because you can't deny science and its ability to change societies and individual bodies for the good. As well as, part of that longer history is also horrible treatment of individuals and much more kinds of malignant attitudes that are also built into the rise of science and the Enlightenment and so on. As you were saying, part of the success, at least in the West, was this, sort of cutting off of the interior life and thinking more about how to study the natural world objectively in some
way. Sure.
We've seen the 18th into the 19th and into the 20th century where that has led, you know, the most incredible advances and transformations in public health and in medicine, and also the Holocaust, you know.
Right, right.
Questions of, again, of more horrific actions with, you know, in terms of science. So it's, I don't know if I have the answers, but I think in the space, for example, that you mentioned of psychedelics, in, you know, that in that little corner of the larger universe, you see the ways in which science and religion are so integral.
Yes, yes.
What is happening in terms of psychology, in terms of therapy, or therapeutic potential. But I don't think they're still working out how, you know, how a more humanities or religious vision and intervention can, you know, can play a role in the larger clinical context. There seems to be over here a growing a market for psychedelic assisted therapy and having trained guides. And so, you know, there you can see people who are both inside and outside of traditional religions.
Right. Getting
involved. And so that, you know, this is all happening right now in real time. And I think it's, there's a sense in which it's the wild, wild west. But there's also the sense in which, you know, we're going to see how science and religion kind of deal with, you know, and work together to think about what impact psychedelics can have for people suffering from PTSD or whatever may be ailing.
Yeah, well, I suppose we'll do our best to you know, be there for the scientists that might be listening to this. We'll get our definitions right. We'll make sure that we adhere to the scientific method in that way. What, in terms of religion as a definition, it's such a broad term, and I know this is something I was reading from you recently as well. Do you have a definition for religion, or is it something that changes depending on the context?
The latter.
Okay.
Absolutely. And so scientists won't be happy.
Sure.
I refuse, and others besides me. Think that it's possible, you know, to really come up with some kind of objective definition that's universal and that everyone can agree to.
Sure.
And I think that's both writ large in society, but I also see it in my classroom where I kind of go through this exercise, as, you know, probably in every class for the last 30 years or so of my teaching, where, you know, a very important part of the early stages of a semester, I'll try to get them to talk about their definitions of religion. And that is a, in a kind of microcosm, you know, ways in which there are as many definitions to religion as there are students who are in, you know, chairs in the classroom.
Yeah.
Although there might be places of overlap, but still, it's one of those concepts that's slippery and evades any kind of real rooted definition. And then also, of course, there's all the linguistic stuff around, well, you know, where does the word originate? What's its etymology? You know, do other languages have the word religion, for example?
Yeah.
Of course they don't. So it's a very Western concept and category, and has its utility for sure, but also I think has its limitations and baggage that is a whole other podcast, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely.
Reading history that some in your audience no doubt knows.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that is a really interesting idea, you know, this postmodern force that's come into the West now, which is, I always try to understand, I try to do my best, as best I can, you know, to see both sides of it. And, you know, we not necessarily in a political context, but from a clinical standpoint, one of the things that we're really noticing is that, you know, in the 20th century with the rise of the DSM and so forth, it was very kind of, you know, modern, objective truth, you know, absolute definitions and so forth. And we have these categories for mental health issues. You know, we have schizophrenia. And if you exceed this threshold of, you know, of checklists and so forth, then you have schizophrenia, you know, or bipolar or anxiety, whatever it is. Now with the postmodern era, we're noticing that definitions are becoming fuzzier. And I think we need that as well, because truth of life is in the gray, right? But where I notice that people are struggling is how much fuzz, you know, and how much category, you know. And I suppose that kind of leads us back to this idea of, you know, what is religion? How much fuzz can we take in, and how broad can the definition be, so long as we're still talking about the same thing?
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's sort of anything goes mentality around religion.
Sure.
In which there are some boundaries or restrictions or markers that signal more religious or spiritual sorts of activities and ways of thinking.
Mm.
And so that's where I like to hang my hat, is thinking about what are the markers that we can find across different cultures that seem to point to a certain kind of outlook or perspective that works with the label religious. So, you know, I'm not to get all into this, but I try to stay away from the word religion.
Sure.
As a noun. You know, I mean, but people are religious. We're all religious in all kinds of ways.
Mm, mm.
Yeah, I think it's part of the human condition to be religious.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are signs of religious life that have to do with identity, that have to do with transcendence, that have to do with community, that have to do with myth, that have to do with meaning making, that have to do with ritual. That doesn't always line up, whether we're talking about medieval Catholic Europe or, you know, prehistoric Americas and so on. It's very much a moving target, which makes my job so much fun.
Yeah.
I want to both, you know, confuse people as much as possible. The fuzziness, I love how you put that, the messiness of reality.
Yes.
The artificiality of taxonomies and categories that help to bring order to the chaos.
Sure, sure.
And also, as you know, talking about like within psychology, you know, also shifts through time and so on. But, you know, so I think the same as with our religious lives. And that allows me, at least, and up, again, others, not just me, but to open up the possibilities of, again, how we might think about religious, or how we are religious in ways that we might not recognize.
Definitely, definitely. Well, let's elaborate a bit on that, Gary. So, you know, as we move towards, you know, a more secular understanding of the world, perhaps even its value and so forth, where is the place for religion in this day and age? How do you see religious life as a value to someone who's growing up in the 21st century?
I see it in drugs, quite frankly. again, to be pushing it a little bit, but I am writing this book at the moment on religion and drugs. And
I think, cool.
In addition to the incredible depth of our interest in altering our consciousness.
Yes.
And often, for sure, for religious reasons, as well as there might be other reasons. So along with that deep, deep history is, I think, the future of religion in America, or maybe even globally. And so that is where people find the sacred and sources for religious life. And answers to questions that, traditionally we've associated with religion, traditional religions and so on. So, I'm interested, in all kinds of things, but, that would be one example of thinking about music, popular cultures and so on, celebrity. Our religious lives are tied up in sort of sacred sources of meaning and perspective and orientation that are no longer restricted or situated in a church or a temple or, in the Bible or whatever.
Yeah, I think that is an area, and full disclosure, that's actually why I went back to uni to become a psychedelic assisted therapist. I'm so interested in it. Personal reasons as well. I was about 18 or 19, I went to schoolies, which is over here. It's kind of like you finish year 12, you finish senior year in high school, and you're a free kid, and you think you're an adult at that time, don't you? 18, 19, like top of the world. I played around with mushrooms and psychedelics before, so I thought I was pretty well versed in it. I came up, my partner actually moved up to Queensland from Melbourne, which is like, it's a bit of a warmer climate up here, and I'd come up here just to the border in Byron Bay, just about an hour south, and for my schoolies week. And a friend and I, who I'd grown up with, we had a very significant amount of psilocybin, and we thought we'd just go out and have a bit of a party and have a bit of fun, and it was by far the most amount of psilocybin I'd ever had, and it was a transcendently harrowing experience, to put it lightly.
I like how you put that. Yeah, and all just mystical union and joy and euphoria.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yep. Yeah, and unbelievable.
Many stories.
Yeah. But the thing that was so interesting about it was, I look back on that now, and if I'd had the right set and setting, and I've spoken about it so many times on the podcast before, but, I was around a whole bunch of drunk dudes who I didn't know. They were like my mate's friends. One of the guys was like flicking the light switch off and on and doing this in my face and telling me like what I was seeing and everything. And it was just, I was so vulnerable, it was not a good experience at all. But I think if I'd had been in the right set and setting, some of the downloads that I might've received, and the ideas of the self and everything like that, it took me so many years to try to integrate, to find an identity again, because my concept of myself and reality had crumbled to so many layers. I needed a religious map, from a secular point of view. And I think that's why I've been so interested in speaking with people like yourself. A lot of the psychedelic researchers for so long, in many ways, I'm still trying to put the pieces back together. I think now I always will, but I really see a lot of value in, the stuff that you're interested in, the stuff you teach, your writings and your books, because the material life doesn't give us everything, and I think for people who are trying to understand a deeper view of themselves, it actually almost gives them nothing to be so bold.
Right. Well, I was thinking about what you, the phrase you just used, which is, getting the kind of religious map for the secular view or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to ask what you meant by that when you were thinking, you know, and how you think of those terms, religious and secular. Put you on the spot, but because I think of that often, and secular and secularization is certainly, you know, a key reference point for thinking about, you know, contemporary culture or whatever, however you want to mark it historically. And I, you know, I like to sort of go against that and think, well, you know, even with the more secular context we're in, that the religious doesn't disappear, can very much shifts or, becomes attached to other kinds of aspects of our experience and our communities and our identity formation. I don't know what you think of that, but
it's a good point. It's actually a really good point. I think, you know, just to reflect there, I think when I use the word secular, I think what I'm describing there is probably a non kind of Anglo-Christianized, you know, institutionalized religious idea, you know. Whether or not that's the actual definition of secular, I'm not too sure. But I think, you know, I remember reading a lot of, I got heavily into Ram Dass, previously known as Richard Alpert. And his work was really interesting, you know, when he was talking about the psilocybin, experiences that he was having with Timothy Leary. And then he was trying to understand what was going on. And he says that when he went over to India and he started, you know, getting more into Hinduism and these ideas of the East, I suppose that's where I got that phrase from. He said that, you know, they had a map there that they'd been teaching for thousands of years that really described a lot of this stuff in which psychedelics weren't even necessary, you know. And I think that if I had had something like that, and again, you know, completely my fault. I was the one eating the mushrooms. But even still, if I was, you know, even just something as simple as, hey, if you see a door, don't hesitate, you know, go into it. Have that compassionate curiosity. Something like that might have helped a little bit. So,
sure. That's wonderful. I think that's really, a great point in thinking about, especially the psychedelic renaissance and how people are trying to balance again the more clinical with something with the maps, you know.
Yes.
And how do people who are trained as guides work within that realm, and that's only one more public and surface level of the ways in which psychedelics are so much a part of contemporary society. I'm sure it's the same there, but here there are all kinds of more underground psychedelic communities with
definitely
shamans or self-proclaimed shamans or real shamans or however you want to talk about shamanism.
Yeah.
That also is not so, clinically controlled or regulated.
Yes.
But that is, I think working with all kinds of different maps, religious kind of sacred maps, for you know, people who aren't necessarily in need of psychological therapy, you know, for something
definitely
else, but who just wanna go there, want a trip, and want to experience for themselves what the drugs have to offer. And that, you know, that I think that's part of the Wild West nature of the moment that we're in. But the question of the maps and how they get aligned and where they originate will be, again, from a more humanistic point of view, someone who studies comparative religion or thinking about culture and religion, this will be interesting. There's a way in which a map, if I may go on here, the way in which a religious mapping is already taking place within the clinical setting. You know, people are trying to figure out, what's the best way to guide someone through some kind of trip. And what's the proper, ritual setting, proper music, and what kind of mythology is operating within this clinical world of orientation, where expectations going in, faith is already operating. I like to think about those various textures that might be associated with what some would assume to be a very secular setting.
Well, that's a very good point. It is a very good point. How does this idea of religion, weave its way into areas in which, people do view it as a dichotomy and really, is it a dichotomy, or are actually both working? Is it water and oil, or is it actually like salt in water, where they're both actually becoming one?
I think that's important to think, both and instead of either or.
Right. Yeah, definitely. So tell me about this book, Gary. Have you got a working title for it at the moment?
I'm calling it Sacred Drugs, and it's basically coming out of the class that I've been teaching.
Oh, great.
Now for a few years. It's sort of working not just with psychedelics, as I've said before in other times, but thinking about psychoactive drugs across the spectrum. Coffee, I see you're already on it.
Very much so. Some would say I'm addicted, actually.
maybe we'll come back to addiction.
Yes.
And the sacred. Coffee for sure, alcohol, tobacco, chocolate, prescription pills even, and thinking about pharmaceutical industry. So there's a way in which many of these substances help to fuel our religious life, in ways that aren't so coherent or tied to a particular tradition, kind of operate in the same way, whether we're talking about the ritual of coffee drinking in the morning as not a transcendent experience that brings you some kind of mystical heights in union with the divine, but as an ordering, stabilizing force that has a great deal of power, that goes beyond the ritual, but is certainly tied into the substance of what coffee provides. Talk about antidepressants and other, ways in which so much of our religious lives are tied to drugs, And again, that's not surprising. Historically, deep into the evolutionary past, it is absolutely commonplace.
Yes.
We're not uncommon. Certainly Africa, Asia, different continents, had different substances, and again, in terms of prehistory, obviously different variations, but a very common feature in terms of the archaeological records and more. So that's interesting. That's fascinating.
It's really fascinating. It's, even as you're talking there, I think about as a child, like if we just extract the most fundamental concept of what a drug is, it's just something outside of the self that alters one's consciousness. As you're speaking there, I'm thinking about me being a child playing on a playground, and you can stand on those spinny things. And I'm like 6 or 7 years old, and I'm thinking now as an adult, why is there this thing in me that makes me want to get dizzy? get out of my own head.
Okay. Well, I don't, you know, here we go. One of the other areas I try to cover in thinking about these questions, of course, is not just the sort of human evolutionary past, but also animals.
Right. All right.
And, you know, clear evidence that animals will, in the wild, will find substances that will, you know, that are intoxicating and will continue to go back to them, whether you're talking about fermented fruits and elephants or birds, they're, you know, across the animal kingdom. People, scientists have written about this. You know, this is a common feature. And it's led one scientist, a psychopharmacologist who wrote a book called Intoxication, you know, where he argues that this is a part of a larger argument for talking about a universal drive to alter consciousness that's built in our species. Like the drive for sex.
Yeah.
Or food. It's like that basic.
Oh, right, right.
You know, and again, this is not the fringe. It's very much, you can find, you know, all kinds of books that have been written about that. So that's interesting. Yeah. And on your point directly, it's funny, there was recently, and I nabbed it because I was going to use it in my class, was an article that was based on a recent scientific study that looked at, I think it was great apes, who would show this behavior of spinning.
Oh, really?
Just, you know, having a very, you know, keen interest in spinning on their own, you know, in terms of solitary activity.
Right.
In ways that would completely get them dizzy and alter consciousness. And again, this, you know, has repercussions in terms of thinking about, because he also talked about children and the ways in which this is a fairly pretty universal
interesting
phenomenon where kids will somehow instinctually kind of find ways to spin or, you know, be drawn to it. And so there are numerous ways in which we can alter our consciousness for sure. So that's has all kinds of interesting dimensions, but, yeah, but for me, I'm just thinking about the drug component.
Sure.
Because as an agent, as you were saying, you know, as a drug, as an external agent that alters consciousness and moods and perceptions and kind of all kinds of physiological and emotional and mental and spiritual effects.
Definitely, yeah. No, that idea, this evolutionary force, and for it to be so low in so basic in the brain, you know, is a really interesting idea as well. And I think, you know, just hearing you speak there, it would make sense that we would have some sort of adaptation to not only seek comfort and familiarity, but to also seek nuance and spontaneity, almost like shaking the snow globe.
I mean, totally. Yeah, totally. And again, the sort of evidence is bearing that out in terms of the potential for evolutionary impact for spinning the globe or rewiring the brain in various ways, and all kinds of neurological impacts that, you know, psychoactive substances have made a huge impact on our development and as well as, you know, social and cultural development. So, you know, again, how do we live with this urge? How do we deal with this, the sense of wanting to get out of our heads and feel, you know, something different than the ordinary, or find ways again to help, just with the existential stuff of life, as you can predict, for me, clearly in terms of death, you know, you can see all kinds of ways in which drugs and religion and death are interlaced in our deep history, but also today in some ways. But through different life passages, you know, I mean, again, the record shows that the psychoactive drugs, alcohol, whatever, coca leaves, wherever you're looking, could play a very important role, again, around the question of how to make sense of our bodies.
Yeah.
It's a kind of basic religious responsibility, you know, that's part of what religions can do is help us make sense of our bodies.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, I mean, other aspects that are universal in what it means to be alive and human, suffering, aging, and so on, as well as feelings of pleasure,
right.
and euphoria or ecstasy, you know, all of these different aspects of human experience get tied in. I mean, not always, and in every culture and society, but in a number of different settings and cultural contexts that are, you know, undeniably suggest that psychoactive drugs have been an essential part of what it means to be human. I have no idea if that's true, but I like, yeah, that's where I was going. Yeah. But anyway, you know, you think about it, it's you know, it is pretty amazing.
It's absolutely astounding, you know, absolutely astounding. And even with MDMA, you know, what MDMA does for the ecstatic, you know, I think I learned that from you last time, ecstasis. You know, we were talking at around the time when Brian Murarescu's book, The Immortality Key, came out. So I had you on the podcast whilst I was reading that, and my mind was exploding, you know. But that's been an important book, you know, in relation to Thanatos and dying, you know, that idea of if you die before you die, you won't die when you die.
Yeah, I mean, profound and certainly tied into that more ancient Greek cultural setting. Certainly, but also a sentiment that, I think is you can find in different religious cultures as well, you know, sort of ways in which, yeah, you can transcend consciousness, kind of enter into other realms where, in a sense, there's a death and a whatever, rebirth, encounter with some new knowledge and so on. But his book was obviously really important for sort of the public awareness, especially of the possibility, you know, that these different psychoactive substances or psychedelics may have played a role in sort of early church and early kind of Eucharistic rituals and so on. You know, I like that aspect of the book, you know, kind of turn things around, but as part of the zeitgeist we're in, where you know, you're younger than me, but just sort of the living through the war on drugs and how
we're
brainwashed. You know, so many about. Do you have the war on drugs? I mean, you know.
Massively.
Say no for us, but you know, and I get students in my class who, you know, clearly like have no way. You know, had no way of. Ever thinking about drugs as potentially religious,
you know? Yeah, yeah,
positive. And you know, drugs, that didn't mean prescription pills, drugs doesn't mean alcohol,
right? Exactly.
You know how this goes. So it's I think really worth, at least I'm not a proselytizer, you know, I'm not going out and trying to be a guru or some new drug leader.
Yeah.
Not at all. I love education. So I think, you know, this effort to rethink drugs in our lives, you know, is right on. And you know, we're in a moment where people are interested. And as we know, everyone is on drugs.
Exactly. That's the big thing. That really is the big thing there, that point there. And, you know, I think, you know, a friend of mine, Johan Hari, he's written extensively about this, and his book, his first big book, but he's he'd written a book before that. It's called Chasing the Scream, where he actually went back and looked at the history of the war on drugs, and it just the racist undertones that were involved in that with a man named Harry Anslinger, and how weed was so heavily tied to the, you know, the African American community, and how the this guy's inherent racism drove this thing, you know, so a really dark past.
Yeah, no, I mean, very much so, and still intertwined with the sacred, you know, even as the in terms of that racism. Racism coming out of a very Protestant white sort of sensibility and morality. So again, even there, as we think about religion, doesn't have anything to do with the war on drugs. You know, it's there are ways in which you can tease out how religious impulses and sensibilities were very much a part of all of the legal political crowd.
Yeah, totally. Well, Gary, look, I want to be respectful of your time, my friend, and I always feel like the hour goes far too quickly, which is it's good and bad. It's bad because it means, you know, I've still got a bit of coffee here, so we could keep going whilst I'm on drugs, but good, it means you have to do a round three. So,
hey, I was thinking the same thing. I mean, I feel the same way. It's kind of hard to stop, but I know there's more. So, you know, we can make arrangements again and do this again. Great.
Yeah, definitely. Let's hope that we're not in a chat GPT 48 world by then, and we're speaking through a hologram or something.
Well, it'll be you and me face to face, or as face to face as this Zoom can be. Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. Well, Gary, thank you so much, mate. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. And for anyone that would like to know more about you and would want to stay up to date with, you know, for example, when this book comes out and so forth, where's the best place to find you?
I'm easy to find, you know. So the website is just GaryLatterman.com and some of the usual places. At least for now, I'm on Twitter. Instagram for sure. And, you know, I try to keep up and keep, you know, kind of public on these developments. So very easy to find.
Beautiful. Gary, thank you so much. Guys, as always, thank you so much for listening. I'll speak to you next week. Bye-bye.